Greg Kokel here in the beautiful north woods of northern Wisconsin. Still up here, still enjoying it. The leaves are turning rapidly now, and my wife is flying in this evening, so today's a good day for me. And I'm looking forward to having this time with you, as I always do. And by the way, just to bring you up to date, or a reminder, we are still having our reality conference in both Washington and Minnesota. It'll be in Bellevue, right outside of Seattle, in Washington State, and that's October 16 and 17, and Minneapolis, of course, in November 13 and 14. And all our full complement of speakers is going to be there, except for Tim. I think he's still locked behind the Iron Curtain there that represents the border between Canada and the United States right now. So, but the rest of our crowd is going to be there, and we're looking – Truth Is Not Ice Cream is a theme of that particular conference, and for both of them, both in Seattle and in Minneapolis. And just to let you know, though, we have very limited ability to take signups. So instead of thousands, there are going to be hundreds because of social distancing, et cetera. So if you have not signed up yet, now is the time to do it. Okay, go to realityapologetics.com and you can register there. All the details are there. I think what our limit is in the main, like, sanctuary. At least in Seattle, is like 200 people. And then there'll be an additional overflow for 200 more. So 400's the total. And we're moving towards that first 200 already. So if you want to get the best seats in the main auditorium, you want to get signed up as soon as possible. Realityapologetics.com is the place to go to do that. Now, a few weeks ago, I talked with you a little bit about reflections that I had made many years ago on what it means to be a good teacher or a good, not so much a good communicator, that's a different set of skills, but what qualities or virtues should a person have if he's going to be an effective teacher or communicator? And I mentioned that this would be true, not just for people like on our staff or our team of speakers or a pastor, but even those who are in smaller group settings, and even parents in teaching their own children. And I mentioned there are four characteristics, and I said a good one of them, one of the characteristics of a good teacher is that he's or she is teachable. That is, they are open to learning and open to unlearning too. In other words, they're open to being corrected, and that's the harder part. A lot of people are open to learn, but not unlearning something that they've learned in the past that's wrong. Okay, so anyway, so a good teacher is teachable, and a good teacher is transparent. In other words, they are forthcoming, or how did I put it? They were visible about their own humanity, basically. They're ordinary human beings, foibles, drawbacks, difficulties, just like everybody else, but they have a role here to teach, and they're going to do their best at doing it. So that's another good quality. By the way, those two qualities are characteristic of newer teachers. When you get when you've been around for a while, you're not quite as transparent. You don't want people to see the real you because people are looking up to you, you know, and so you don't want to knock yourself off the pedestal. But sometimes that's a good idea. In other words, that we step down from that because we do, I think, people a disservice if we put on airs like that, okay? Especially spiritual airs, because it makes it seem like I used to think of my spiritual leaders when I was a fairly new Christian. I thought, man, I could never attain to what they do. They probably never even sin anymore. You know, I actually believe that. Of course, you and I know this isn't true, but this is the way I look at it. And sometimes people in leadership encourage that kind of idea, and I think that's a mistake, all right? The other two characteristics, though, are characteristic of older teachers because of their experience, but are not present so much in neophytes. And that is concreteness, which is an ability to I don't have my notes in front of you, so I don't remember exactly how I described it. You'll get the full description if you go to the podcast for the end of August. I think that's when I did it. But concreteness is so you can you teach it in a crisp way so that people can sink their teeth into what you're saying. Okay, it's substantive. It's not vague. But the other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit more today is being balanced. And the way I describe balance is that you hold your theological views by being informed by the full counsel of God. So being balanced doesn't mean a little bit of this and then a little bit of the opposite, so we don't go too much in too far in one direction or the other. That's not what I mean by balance. So it isn't like, well, grace is really important, but if we have too much grace, well, that turns to license. So we have to balance that out with law. So we have a little law and a little grace. But the scripture doesn't teach a little law and a little grace. It actually teaches so much grace that it can be mistaken for license, which is precisely why Paul, after writing what he did in Romans chapter 4 and chapter 5, and in chapter 4 he says, but for him who does not work but believes in a God who justifies the ungodly, to him it's reckoned as righteousness. It's a hyperbole. It just shows that righteousness is unrelated to our works. That's the point. Not that we shouldn't work, but our righteousness is not related to work. And so he speaks that way in chapter 4 and then chapter 5, more grace, 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 grace. And he's anticipating an objection when he starts in chapter 6. And the objection is, wait a minute, if there's so much grace, then maybe we should sin it up so that grace can abound. And Paul says, man, whoa, hold on. You're missing the point here. This isn't how it works. And then he explains in chapter 6. But here's what I want you to see. And that is, in this particular case, if you are not teaching God's grace in a way in which it might be mistaken for license, then you are not teaching grace the way Paul taught grace. Now, we have to correct that problem. But in a proper understanding of grace is what provides us balance. It isn't a little law and a little grace. Okay, so you got the general idea there. And what I thought I'd do here is I would give a small tutorial in exactly how I go about accomplishing that particular task. For example, I got a email, I think it was this morning or maybe yesterday, from one of my staffers who asked if I could if I knew of a good book on demon possession. And my answer is no, I don't. And the ones I've seen, I have not been very happy with theologically. But I did suggest this. If you want to at least get your own primer on demon possession, the best thing to do is just go to the scriptural texts that talk about that thing. That is, since we have examples of demon possession in the Gospels and also in the book of Acts, and we have people dealing with possessed individuals in the Gospels, Jesus, and the disciples too, but we don't have records of that. We just know that they're doing it because they talk about it. And then in the book of Acts, we have, I think, Peter and Paul have to deal with a demon-possessed individual and cast out a demon. So what I suggested to my staffer is do what I was talking about a few weeks ago, find out just by using the scriptures inductively. That means going to the text and gathering your information from the textual references and make a study guide or a summary of what you learned just by looking at New Testament texts about demon possession. And it's actually not that hard. You might, use a concordance or something like that, but I suggest you do something different because sometimes a concordance will cause you to miss texts that deal with demons in the New Testament where maybe the word demon is not used. Now that I think about it, in the case of demons, there probably aren't any cases like that. But if we're doing studies on other things, like prayer, for example, and there's a lot of prayers in the New Testament that don't have the word prayer in them. So if you use a concordance, you're not going to find those verses if you're doing a broader study on prayer. Here's what I suggest. Go to the Gospels and start at Matthew, and then skim read with the purpose of resting on those passages where you have examples of demonic activity, demon possession, and in Jesus dealing with them. And get yourself open a doc, grab all the verses pertaining to that thing from your Bible thing online or whatever, and throw it into your document. Okay, there's one example. For example, Mark 5 is the demonian, the Gadarene demoniac. Did I say demonian? I did. The Gadarene demoniac. I remember once when I was at Hope Chapel and I was a pastor. Somebody said, "Where are Norwegians from?" And somebody else said, "Norwegia?" They were genuinely confused. It's one of those things. Anyway, so you have the Gadarene demoniac in Mark 5, and you have parallel passages in Matthew and Luke. Okay, and I just isolated that particular passage, that particular event. And I got it right in front of me, my notes on it. I grabbed all the information from Matthew, all the information from Mark, and all the information from Luke. And my goal was, what does a demon-possessed person, or what kind of characteristics do they manifest? I've had people would come to me and said, "Yeah, I was at this event, or I went to this place, I was talking to that person, whatever, and I think he was demon-possessed." I said, "Well, what would make you think that they're demon-possessed?" "I could see it in their eyes." Now, seeing it in their eyes, as far as I could tell, is not a biblical criterion of demon possession. So if you want to know, does the Bible have anything to say about what people who are demon possessed are like? The answer is yes. And so, for example, I'm just looking at the parallel accounts here, Matthew 8, Mark 5, and Luke 8. Of the Gadarene demoniac, actually there were two of them, not just one, although the Markan account focuses just on one of the individuals. It's not a contradiction. It's just an occasion where the focus is on one rather than the other. But when I went through those texts on my document here and I started highlighting in bold the characteristics that I saw there. And in Matthew it said, for example, they were coming out of the tombs. Why were they coming out of the tombs? Because that's where they lived. They lived in the graveyard. That's a little bit odd, isn't it? Okay. And they were exceedingly violent so that no one could pass by the road. Oh, there's another characteristic. I read in Mark, yes, they were dwelling among the tombs. And when they had been shackled with chains, they were able to tear the chains apart. That means they had superhuman strength. And then they were gashing themselves with stones. So this is like self-mutilatory behavior. And the demons spoke from outside of the human. In other words, it wasn't the human person talking. It was the demon crying out with a loud voice. And this demon is identified as an unclean spirit by Jesus in the text. In Luke, we learn that these guys were running around naked. They'd not put on any clothing for a long time. They were not living in a house, but in a tomb. And once they were relieved, the text says there they were sitting clothed and in their right mind. Okay? So now what we have here is biblical descriptions of demon-possessed people with certain defining characteristics. There's bizarre behavior, living in the tombs, running around naked. They are violent. They have superhuman strength. They are pursuing self-mutilatory behavior. And they're speaking with another voice. Now, that's just one passage. I should say three passages, but all on the same account. Okay? And what I had begun doing, I actually didn't pursue this anymore, but this was a start. And I could have gone through all the rest of the accounts to see if there are any more characteristics. But what have I done? I've gone to the Bible and inductively extracted particular pieces of information that let me know biblically characteristics of demonically possessed people. So if I find some guy who is bizarre running around living in a tomb and is naked and has superhuman strength and is gashing himself and speaking with other voices, well, chances are pretty good that person has a demon. What if they don't have all those characteristics? Well, in different places of the scripture, we see different characteristics. I think speaking with another voice is pretty significant. That is another speaking through you, that is the demon inside. Not all self-mutilatory behavior is demonic, though. This ought to be pretty obvious. And there's been a fad of cutting in the last 10 years. But I don't think that people who are cutting are necessarily demon-possessed. Although it does occur to me, given that people who in the Bible who are demon-possessed, some of them are characterized by self-mutilatory behavior, that maybe there is a demonic element that is involved in this trend. Something to think about. But I hope you could see what I'm doing here. What I'm doing here is I'm trying to form my opinions about a specific theological thing from the text itself, and not just from one text. I've just given you some examples of one text, one event. But if I were to continue this study, I'd just go speed read through Matthew, then through Mark, then through Luke, and then through John, and isolate all these passages in a document, and then start looking at them. Now, a couple of things are going to happen. One thing that's going to happen is it's actually kind of cool to speed read through a gospel. And I don't mean like, what was that speed reading thing that people used to do about 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, you know? It's not like you're trying to catch every little thing. I'm saying you're skimming to find those sections that talk about demons or whatever your topic is that you're focusing in on. And then you're slowing down and looking carefully at those things. And then when you're done with that text, you say it and zing right through and you start skimming through until you find another one. You'll be amazed at how much sticks, even though you're skimming and not really reading. And whenever I do this, I always come away with a more robust understanding of the book. You're not isolated like a lot of preachers are in one verse for 3 weeks. You're reading, skimming through the passage quickly, and as a result, you're getting a more robust understanding of the book itself. That's kind of cool. But secondly, by taking all of the passages that pertain to the particular topic you're studying and then kind of gazing at them all, you are going to get the full counsel of God on that particular issue. Now, for some issues, it's not, I guess, practical to try to look at all the verses like grace. There's a lot of verses that deal with grace, but you kind of get the general idea. I did once with I did this whole technique with a discipleship group that I had, and we looked at the New Testament in prayer. Everything the New Testament said about prayer, every prayer that was there, every reference, and we divided up the text and gathered our stuff together and then made an outline based on the different things that we found there. And I think I mentioned to you before, the thing that was most prevalent was the emphasis on thanksgiving, either encouragement to pray with thanksgiving or prayers of thanksgiving. And so that was an eye-opener for me. But it kind of helped me see that issue more in balance. What is the biblical balance? And then not get way off into one side or way off in the other because I've found a verse that I'm making do all of the work for me with prayer. And sometimes there are groups that do that. I mean, I'm thinking of Word Faith type crowd who are focusing in on if you believe, then it's going to happen kind of verses. And there's more to faith and prayer, etc., in the New Testament than just those verses. Okay, so there's an example. Maybe later on in the show, depending on how the callers come in, I'll give you some more examples of this. I actually did this once with the Book of Acts too. Maybe I can say something about that here. I'm looking at the clock. Now, let's go to break, and then I'll take a couple calls, and I might come back to this later on in the show, all right? But this is just a small tutorial giving you an inside look in how I do some of the studying. It doesn't take a lot of spiritual insight, by the way. It doesn't take a lot of giftedness to gather up all the verses and lay them out there in a doc and print it out if you need to, put all the pages and start looking around and start circling words and underlining things that are similar so you can kind of get a sense of the full counsel regarding that particular issue. I've done it a number of times, and it's Proverbs is really good for this because just pick a topic like business. I actually did an article somebody asked me to do for another publication once on bribes from the book of Proverbs. Are bribes good or bad? Sometimes they sound like they're good, and sometimes they sound like they're bad in the book of Proverbs. So this is what I did, what I just described. Got all the verses together, put them all in front of me, and then I actually was quite surprised at what I learned was the teaching of the book of Proverbs on the issue of bribes or gifts to influence or something. Maybe someday I'll talk to you about that. But anyway, this particular technique has served me in good stead and helped me as a teacher to be more balanced in my understanding of what the Word of God actually does teach. Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. Let's take a break and then to your calls.
Why is the problem of evil still a problem for many skeptics and atheists? It's because they refuse to accept a fundamental reality that every Christian believes in. Find out what that is in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or the top of the homepage at str.org.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
Greg Kokel here, your host on Stand to Reason. With you every Tuesday night, this is the live show, and actually we have people that listen live, I think, and that is they stream from the internet, a little different than we used to have it for so many years doing a live radio show on the weekends, but this just turned out to be a better situation for us, and most of you know to call on Tuesday evenings from, let's see, what's the time in California right now? I'm in Wisconsin, so I'm all discombobulated, to call from 4 to 6 p.m., Los Angeles time, and Amy Hall, the great and wonderful Amy, will take your call and put you in the queue. And she has done that with Catherine in California. So, Catherine, there we go. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, does Jesus have a physical body right now? And does that mean he has a physical location somewhere in the universe?
You know, I have wondered about Well, let's see. This question has occurred to me a number of times. I think I have an answer for it, but it's going to be a little bit vague. The answer to the first part of the question is yes, Jesus did have a physical body, sort of. And the reason I say sort of is that it was a physical body. In fact, when Jesus, after the resurrection, appeared to the disciples, they thought they were seeing a ghost, you know. And he said, look it, I'm not a ghost. I'm not a spirit. I'm me. Look it. Touch my hands and feet. Look it. Give me some fish. I'll eat some fish. So he was capable of being not just beheld, but touched. Okay, and he could eat, so he had a body that could function in those ways. It was a genuine physical body. In fact, a resurrection. Let's put it this way: if it's not a physical body, it's not a resurrection. And I know that people, there are certain groups who will say that Jesus was raised in a spiritual body. If he's raised in a spiritual body, it's not a resurrection, because a resurrection is a resuscitation of that which died. It's not another part of you like a spirit kind of floating around and showing up. It's his body, yeah, that came out of the grave. So, and that's why there was no body in the grave. The tomb was empty. Okay, so Jesus did have a real physical body. The part that's hard about it, though, Catherine, is the nature of that body. And Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 15. And it's like he's struggling to find the words to describe something indescribable. Because though it's a physical body, it's a resurrected physical body, and so therefore it has different characteristics than the physical bodies we have now. It has some of the same characteristics. That's why Jesus could be recognized. That's why he could be touched. That's why he could eat, etc. But also it has other characteristics. Like Jesus, when he showed up to the disciples, they were in a locked room. Now, somebody said, yeah, he could pass through walls. I don't think he passed through the wall. I think he just showed up. You know, I don't think he kind of showed up in the hallway and then walked through the wall. I think he just showed up in the room. But nevertheless, that's something we can't do with this body. So there are elements about the spiritual body that are unique, okay, and therefore give it unique capabilities and characteristics. And Paul describes some of that in 1 Corinthians 15. But even though he has a hard time explaining all of the details, I think he does. I read it and I have a hard time understanding it. Let's just put it that way. Maybe others do a better job with 1 Corinthians 15. But Paul is just saying this is a unique situation. He still is emphasizing that it is a real resurrected body. And this is why he says, you know, about halfway through the chapter, you know, how could people say there is no resurrection from the dead? Because if they say there is no resurrection, then Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then we're lying. And if we're lying and Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we're still in our sins and we're of most men to be pitied, he said, if the resurrection isn't something that genuinely happened. So there's a real resurrection body, okay? But now where is that thing? Where is he? He did go up. First chapter of Acts, we see an account of him rising up. All the poor disciples are standing there looking in the sky, and they're standing there, and Jesus is gone, and they're still looking and looking and looking. And finally, the angels say, hey, wake up, guys. Go to work, man. He's gone. He'll come back when he said he's going to come back, which nobody knows, but he knows. And he's got his own timetable. You guys got to get to work. And so he sends them out to do the job of spreading the gospel in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost parts. But what happened up there? Where did he go then? He didn't drift off to another planet. I do not think that he is in this physical universe. And part of the reason is because of the texts that say that he is seated at the right hand of the Father. And in fact, when Stephen is being martyred, he actually sees Jesus next to the Father. How we are supposed to understand that, I don't know, but he certainly sees something, and it's Jesus, and he is standing as if to receive Stephen in the martyrdom, and that's in the book of Acts. But and so the information we're given is Jesus is in a physical body, which is a unique resurrected body, and he is with the Father. And he's doing some things there. He's interceding for us, for example, and other things the scripture says. But I have no reason to believe that Jesus is anywhere in the physical universe. He's in a non-physical realm with a physical body, and he's able to do that because the physical body that he has is the kind of physical body that can be in that kind of realm and still be a physical body. And that's about all I can say about it, because that's kind of odd. What do you think, Catherine?
Well, I was listening up until that last part when you said that he's in a physical body in a non-physical place, and then you lost me.
I'm sorry. I had a little hard time understanding that. Can you
hear me better now?
I can hear you, but the words are just a little muffled, like you're too close to the microphone or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
No, this is better now. Yeah, go ahead.
I think I was listening up until you said that he's in a physical body in a non-physical place.
Yeah, right. It's because the non-physical space is unique, and so is the physical body unique. It's not like just exactly like ours.
Well, I just mean, like, in what sense would it be a physical body if it's in a non-physical space?
I'm really sorry. I'm just having a hard time. I catch different words, but I can't hear the whole question.
Let me change up my phone.
Okay.
Is this any better?
That's a little bit better.
Okay. It's better on speakerphone, apparently. I was wondering, in what sense is his body physical if it's in a non-physical space?
Well, see, that sounds like an odd thing, and it is, but that's why I had to simply qualify it. We know he's not in the physical world. He's with the Father, and he's interceding for us. Okay, we know that. That's a piece of the puzzle we know. We know that he has a physical body, but it's a resurrected physical body, so it's different. We know that as well by the examples that I gave to you from the text. Okay, now what? Well, this physical body that's unique must be unique in a way that it can be with the Father and still be physical. And I don't know how I can take it any further than that. It's not the same, exactly the same kind of physical body that we have. It's a resurrected physical body. If I looked in 1 Corinthians 15, I might find some more information that would be helpful. But essentially, that's the way I would sum it up. Okay, it's a longish passage that he talks about the resurrected body, and he does say, by the way, this is what we're going to have. The mortal will put on immortality, and the perishable will put on the imperishable. So we have some more details there, but it is kind of mysterious, I have to admit.
Okay, well.
I wish I could tell you more, but it's one of those things we'll figure it out when we get there, all right?
Yeah.
All righty.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I don't know if she sounded better on her speakerphone, or was she on speakerphone at first and went to the regular handset? Usually handsets are better, okay? So just FYI, friends, I just have a hard time sometimes making out the individual words, and if that's the case, it's hard to have a conversation. Let's go to Beth in Phoenix, Arizona. Hello, Beth.
Hi there. So here's my question.
Okay.
So I have an Airbnb in my home, and I'll take off my headset right now I have an Airbnb in my home, and it's been like a real ministry. I have somebody right now that just, we had a good conversation early on, and he said that was a really good conversation because he was, you know, telling me about he's had friends of every kind of different religion. And I said, well, and he was like leaving it at that. And I'm like, well, it's important to know the truth. So the next day he said that was a really good conversation. But since then, he just sort of cuts it short, you know, doesn't make himself available. And I'm learning from your book to push it.
Right.
But is there some way that I could? I'm usually really good at it, but maybe I'm just sensing that he's not ready or open, and I should just, you know, maybe give him a hug when he leaves tomorrow morning or something like that, or ask him how I can be praying for him.
Well, let me just, it's not unusual to run into circumstances where you want to share with somebody and they don't want to listen, or maybe they want to listen a little bit, but not too much. And does that sound like your circumstance?
Exactly.
Okay. I was asked something like this on an interview recently, and they asked the question, well, when do you quit? When do you give up, or when do you stop engaging in any given circumstance? How do you know? And I basically had three different things that came to mind. Sometimes I quit before I get started. That is, I realize as I'm trying to get going with somebody, I can't get off the ground. Maybe there'll be a question that I ask, and I talk about that, you know, in the tactical game plan. I'll probe a little bit. I'll get information, and I'll try to see if there's any spiritual interest the person seems to be showing, or at least interest in having conversation with me. I remember there was a young man I was sitting next to on an airplane, back when you could sit next to people on the airplane, and he was reading a book about New Age religion. I saw the title somehow, you know, and I thought, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So tell me what are you enjoying the book? Yeah, I'm enjoying it. What's it about? And he shared a little bit about it, you know, and then I said, do they talk about Jesus at all? Because I know the New Age type crowd, they're always talking about Jesus. They like to get Jesus on their team, so to speak, you know, and they snatch these little things that he said out of context to fit their theology. But so, oh, yeah, they mentioned Jesus. So, I said to the fellow, have you ever read Jesus for yourself? Is what the question I asked. So all I'm just trying to get into this conversation. He said, what do you mean read Jesus? I said, you know, like read Jesus. This is the way I put it. I don't like to say, did you ever read the Bible? You know, because that to me sounds a little corny. And I'd rather have just people read Jesus. So that's the Gospels, of course, but that's the way I put it. And most of the time people respond okay with that, but he just didn't understand what I meant. And so I said, well, you know, read the New Testament, the Gospels. He said, oh, yeah, I read them, but, you know, I don't care about that, you know, or something like that, and totally dismissed me and went right back to his book. And I realized, now I've probed, this is not going anywhere. This guy doesn't want to talk to me. All right, I'm quitting before I get started, basically. I'm not in a conversation with him. It never really got into that. Okay. Second, so I don't know, with the friend that you have in mind, I missed a couple of the details there, but it sounded like you were able to converse a little bit, but it got a little stale or he got tired quickly and wanted to move on. Is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is number two. If I've sensed that somebody is losing interest, if we're talking a little bit and they're losing interest, they don't want to continue, okay, I'm not going to keep going with it. I'm just going to let it go. I do not want that person to feel overwhelmed. I don't want to feel that right. person to feel like I'm pushing them or trapping them or whatever, you know. And if they're not lifting their head, so to speak, like my sheep hear my voice, they lift their head, so to speak, in John chapter 10.
Oh.
You know, that's a passage related to evangelism. It's not related to Christian living the way most people use it. But Jesus said, you know, my sheep hear my voice. So the ones that are mine are going to lift their head and respond. And others, just as one friend told me once, just keep eating grass. So if I sense the person is keep eating grass or goes back to eating grass, in the illustration I just gave you here, that person kept eating grass. He never really looked up much. But if you're talking and then they start to lose interest, I'm going to let it go. Or if I have given them enough information that I think is enough for one person to chew on for a little bit, I don't want to overwhelm them. Mm-hmm. I don't want to leave them with a bad taste in their mouth, so to speak, for having talked with me because I just overwhelmed them. Okay. So this is why I talk about gardening, Beth. I a little here, a little there, a little here, you know. Okay. So I also, so those are the basic circumstances. If I can't get started, then I don't get started. If I get started, but then the person seems to lose interest, I'm just going to let him go, or her go, as the case may be. And gotcha. Even if they're listening for a while, and it's more of a casual encounter, I'm going to try to give them something to think about, but I'm going to try not to overwhelm them with too gotcha. Much. Okay. So I don't know if that fits your circumstance so much. It sounds a little bit like you got a person that is somewhat interested, but then, you know, okay, that's enough for me right now and doesn't want to go any further with it.
Yes.
This is someone that you see on a regular basis, right?
Well, I have an Airbnb in my home, and it seems like God really uses it to, like, bring me people. And then I pray for them, and I ask God for opening. And sometimes I get them, and...
Yeah, you know what? I don't know why I can't make your words out, and I have to apologize for that, but I just can't... It's not coming across clearly. I don't know if people have phone. But
I have one of those big old iPhone classes, but... I'm going to go outside and talk about it.
Are you on a cell phone? Is that it?
In my home. Pardon?
Are you on a cell phone?
Yes.
Okay. It's just like
Airbnb.
So fuzzy that I can hear the ups and downs, but I can't make out any of the words.
Oh.
So.
Okay,
I understood the O.
I have an Airbnb in my home.
Oh, home?
And God uses it a lot.
I gotcha. That's good. And that's good. I can understand those words too. So that means you have opportunities at different times to talk with people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is where, you know, you use your game plan, start asking questions, draw them out. Some people are more aggressive than others. I tend to be depending on the circumstances, in casual encounters, a little less aggressive than some, but in more professional encounters, I'll be more aggressive. Like if I'm at an event, then they know that I'm there to talk about this particular thing. Then with non-Christian
right.
people that I'm engaged with, I'll be more aggressive. But anyway, everybody's got their own speed and their own style, that kind of thing. And so you kind of find your own groove. But I think using the questions just to see if there's spiritual interest is a great way to get going. And if somebody then loses interest, well, that's okay. I mean, God knows. God's the one who's in charge of this anyway. Then there's not much
right.
we can do.
Right. That's just encouraging because I thought, am I losing my touch or?
Well, okay. Well, if you're losing your touch, it's a touch. I never really had that. Well, people have different capabilities, and there's sometimes there're going to be things that just fall flat. All right. And other times it's going to be the easiest thing imaginable. I remember I gave an illustration of one conversation on an airplane. I've had lots of them. And I remember a young lady that was sitting next to me. She was a Muslim. And I honestly don't remember how we got into the conversation. Lots of times people say, how do you get into them? I said, I don't know how that happened, but I'm using my asking. Pardon me?
Yeah, that's how I am.
Well, I'm using questions, and I'm just talking and just trusting God to open the doors, you know. And sometimes so she said that she was thinking about Islam, but she was concerned about it because of all the bad things that were happening by Muslims in the world, the terrorism and stuff. She was wondering whether it was the right religion or not, or she's having misgivings. And so I said, let me offer you one difference between the God of Christianity and the God of Islam. And then I talked to her about, well, the illustration I gave her was if I were to, let's say terrorists were taking over a plane and they were going to drag you out and kill you on the tarmac, and I put my hands in front of you and I said, don't take her, take me instead.
Ooh.
I said, I asked her, what would you think about that? She said, I cannot imagine anyone doing that for me. It was really sweet, a very genuine response. And then I said, but that is what God has done for you already. Not Allah, Yahweh, not Muhammad, Jesus. Jesus spoke to the Father and he said regarding sinners, take me instead. And that was the exchange. I actually talk about this in the story of reality. I have this anecdote in there because I think it perfectly describes what Jesus did on our behalf. He made an exchange, his life for our life, you know, take me instead. So, but that was one of those conversations where it just was effortless. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
There were no speed bumps or anything. In fact, it was a short flight because it was from Jacksonville down to Miami in Florida. So it was a short hop. And she had sat next to me somewhat by accident because a husband and wife were split up. She was behind. He was next to me. And the young lady was sitting next to her. And so he asked the young lady I was talking with, the Muslim, if he could switch seats with her. And so she said yes. And now she's plopped down next to me, which is great. We have this wonderful conversation. So this is a divine appointment. I only knew that because of how it all turned out. And she was so excited. She was so excited that when she landed, she turned around to the person behind her, the gentleman she had switched seats with. And she said, I can't believe it. This man is telling me about Christianity and Jesus. And her eyes were big as saucers, and she was really excited. Now, the guy behind us probably thought, so what? Big deal. Who cares, you know? But she was just beside herself with excitement. Now, I don't know whatever became of her, okay? God knows. But I only give that – pardon me?
I said, yeah.
Yeah, God does know. So, but I use that as an example because here I was in the one case trying my darndest to get into a conversation I could never get going, and I fell flat on my face. In another case, it was the easiest thing in the world, and there was a very receptive individual, and that was a case where I just had the sense the sheep is lifting her head. She's hearing the voice of Jesus after a fashion, you know. And that's actually what Jesus meant in John chapter 10 when he used that metaphor, that there is a sense in which those who are his respond to the message and follow him is the point that he's making there in John 10. Anyway, so just keep doing the best you can, Beth. I appreciate your call. And I wish there was more that I could tell you. These things are not always tidy affairs. And there's no silver bullet. There's no fancy schmancy way to make it smooth and clever and powerful every time around. We go out there and we do what we can, and we let the Lord take care of the rest. That's kind of my attitude about it.
This has been so encouraging, Greg. I love your books, and I'm trying to talk all my friends into doing it. And somebody with Alliance Defending Freedom here in Scottsdale has done a Bible study at Scottsdale Bible Church, and we told her how we get together and we practice, and so we're going to practice the techniques on Thursday. And I'm trying to get my church to do it because I think it far better than learning. They're trying to get us to do a new Four Spiritual Laws book, and I just think this is more for our times.
Yeah. Well, I used to, when I was a fairly new Christian during the Jesus movement, I used the four laws quite a bit. I don't use them now. I find different ways to communicate the same ideas. But generally, I'm not in harvest mode. I'm in gardening mode, as you know. And and four laws is kind of a, do you want to pray to receive Christ kind of harvest technique. And I've actually prayed with people to receive Christ using four laws, but it's been a long time. So anyway, Beth, it's good talking to you, and I appreciate the call.
Thank you. Bye, Greg.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye now. All right. Let's go to break, and then I've got some closing comments for the top of the hour.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRask. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRask is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRask. That's hashtag STRask. Great hearing Tim talking about RPL, Red Pen Logic, and that's a tremendous amount of fun. We've worked a lot of projects together and doing RPLs together, and it's kind of a joint project. But he's got the rubber face, and he's got the great ideas, and he's the one with the red pen, and he's doing all the heavy lifting for that. And I have a wonderful time working with him on it. And the final product is fabulous. So if you have not checked out Red Pen Logic on YouTube, go there and watch a couple of the episodes, and we'll be doing more. I think we're trying to do one every 2 weeks, and so building up the number that's there. Greg Cash over at STR, our videographer, does such a magnificent job as well. I wanted to close out this show with just another example of how I try to zero in on a particular issue and solve a problem for myself by isolating a passage and then just doing the grunt work of separating out verses pertaining to my topic and discovering something absolutely amazing. Here was the problem I was trying to resolve. I had been frustrated listening to people talk about or offer the gospel, make appeals regarding the gospel in very particular ways. And the appeals were heavily emphasizing the love of God in relationship with God. Come to Christ because you'll experience God's love and you can have a relationship with God. Now, I think that's true. I don't take exception with the claim, and I think this is really true. The problem for me was it did not seem to be balanced. That is, there's more to the message than just that. And so I thought, well, how would I know how the early disciples, for example, preached the gospel? And then I realized we have a record of that. The entire book of Acts is a record of the disciples preaching the gospel. And these were people who were trained by Jesus himself. I wonder what they said. Now, I had read through Acts in a number of times and read the different preachments that we find there, but I had never read it with an eye to looking specifically at the kinds of things they said and the way they presented the gospel. And so I went through the book of Acts. I did my little speed reading deal, and I found and I captured every section where the gospel was preached. I think there are 13 occasions where the gospel is preached. And then I asked myself a couple of questions. For example, Acts chapter 2, 14 to 39, this Pentecost Sunday, I asked myself, who's preaching? What do they say? And what do they say about God's love and relationship with God? Okay, ask the same question. And so I started taking notes. I made a summary. Oh, here's Peter, and he's saying this stuff, and the emphasis is on forgiveness of sin by Jesus the Messiah. No mention of God's love or relationship, Acts 2. Okay, next one, Peter at the Gate Beautiful, Acts 3. Emphasis on forgiveness of sin by Jesus the Messiah. No mention of God's love or relationship with him. And I kept going down through all of these different ones. And when I got to the end, I was stunned at what I had discovered. In not a single case of the 13 times the gospel is preached in the book of Acts by the people who were trained by Jesus himself, and this would include Paul, because even though Paul was Saul and he became a Christian after Jesus rose from the dead and etc., he still was trained by Jesus, and he talks about that in Galatians, I think chapter 1 or chapter 2, okay? So he was tutored by Jesus personally. We know this. And in not a single case does any of them mention anything about a relationship with God. I was stunned to read that, or not to read that, I guess. Where is it? Where is this emphasis on relationship? Now, it isn't that there's no relationship. Obviously, there is, but it wasn't what the disciples led with. They led with something else. They characterized the project in a very different way than we characterize it now. They didn't characterize it subjectively the way we characterize it. This is what you'll get from it. This is what you'll experience from it. This is what you'll feel as a result of being a Christian. They didn't talk like that. They talked about something, I think, much more foundational, and this is the kind of thing that is hardly talked about at all when we communicate the gospel, and that is the need for forgiveness and the reality of future judgment. And one other thing, last 30 seconds, one other thing that really surprised me, not only was there no reference to relationship with God as part of the appeal of the preaching of the book of Acts, they never once mentioned the love of God. In fact, the word love doesn't even appear in the entire book of Acts. Now, it's manifest there, but it doesn't appear there because it wasn't the way they preached in the book of Acts. Now, I don't know what you're going to do with your own theology regarding that. You can find this whole document titled The Preaching of God's Love in Acts. It's on our website, The Preaching of God's Love in Acts, and make your own decisions and make your own applications. But that's a good example of trying to be more balanced, biblically speaking, in the way we preach. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven. Bye-bye now.